the name of God. Thank you for coming. This is, as is announced, our fifth session. And now we are embarking on the lofty issue of love. Actually, so far we have postponed the issue of love, and we have made some arrangements and some pretext in order to take us to the idea of love, which is the biggest one in Masnavi. As you remember, I remember in my first session that Masnavi is the book of love, and for him, i.e. for the Rumi, love was the main concept that he learned, and he took it from Shams, his master and his mentor. And his mysticism before meeting Shams was mysticism of fear, but then of course it changed into the mysticism of love. By far, Rumi is the prophet of love in the whole territory of Persian and Arabic literature, and according to the testimony of some of the literary men of the West, not only in Persian and Arabic but in the whole world literature. Indeed, love not only is his main concept through which he explains the world, man, history, God and everything, but it is his main teacher. And as I alluded to in the past session, for him not only God is love, but love is God as well. So the importance of the idea becomes clearer when we go on, when we move on in this lecture. The distinction or the polarity of love and intellect is very telling, and that's why I have chosen to talk about this particular polarity between love and the intellect or the reason or rationality. Of course, there are a number of things to be said about love, especially divine love according to Rumi, but this particular distinction is more significant and can teach us and tell us a lot about Rumi's school and his grand world view. Like other mystics, Rumi does not bother about defining things. This is the business of philosophers and logicians. When they talk about love, about God, about history, about man, about theology, everything, they have to start with giving a precise definition of the concept they are going to talk about, and then move on into arguments and counter-arguments and evidence and counter-evidence, suppositions, certainties, and the ideas of the scholars and so on and so forth. But Rumi's style is not like that, nor for that matter the style of any other contemplative or mystic. He just pours out his own personal experience about love, about any other thing that he's about to discuss. So Rumi's materials, like all other mystics, are very personal, very individual. So when you listen to him, you are really listening to him, himself. And you are not, of course, I mean, you should not go about in order to see what he has borrowed from others and what is specifically his and so on. These are, of course, scholarship that sometimes are being done. But in Rumi's case, one has to have an ear in order to see, to hear his own personal voice. Only in one place, I would say, he gives a very cursory definition of love, and that is not a definition per se in a logical sense of the word. Nevertheless, it helps us, it can tell us something about what really Rumi thought of love. This is the more important because we are now living in an age, we are living in I would say, in a country in which the word love is perhaps the most frequently used word. Therefore, in order to get rid of the confusion, we better listen to Rumi, what he thinks of love, of divine love, and then go on explaining the characteristics and the attributes of love. I just read you a few lines from the introduction he wrote to the second book of Matthew. There actually tells us something which might enlighten us and gives us a clue as to what is to be considered as love in Rumi's point of view. In one anecdote, he said, someone asked me, i.e. Rumi, what is love? I answered, thou wilt know when thou becomest lost in me, or thou becomest like me. The Persian is, Kuttanki Fama Shadi Bedani. I told him, when you become like me, you will understand what is love. Therefore, love is an experience, and it is not to be defined in words. And we can just point out to the love, and especially through lovers, through becoming familiar with lovers, you will know what love is, not through words, not through philosophical definitions, as I said. So the best way in order to have an experience is to sit with those who have such an experience, to get familiar with them, to make company with them, and to share their experience, so to speak. That will tell you what love is. But he goes on, and he does not stop here, and say, love is uncalculated affection. Well, Nicholson's translation is uncalculated. Perhaps he should have said, better have said, uncalculable affection. Even as the word affection, I am somehow doubtful about it. Maybe we could replace it with kindness or something, because after all, love, as Rumi is about to tell us, is one of the attributes of God. And the word affection is not to be used with regards to God. So he is not subject to any affection. Affection is a human matter, a human thing, and is not to be used in the case of God and divine attributes. But anyway, perhaps we better translate it. The Persian is mahabbat bihesab, boundless kindness, infinite kindness, uncalculable kindness, or uncalculated affection, according to Rumi. What I would like to emphasize is the uncalculability, the boundlessness, the infiniteness. That is the more important point of this definition, or so-called definition. The infinity of the affection, the boundlessness of the affection or the kindness, is the main characteristic of love. Therefore, it is not to be used, it is not to be applied to any kind of affection. So the boundlessness is a necessary element here. And because of the boundlessness, necessarily it is only one of the attributes of God, because boundlessness and infinity is only God's. All other things are bounded, as you know, are finite, are calculable, or measurable, if you like, and so on and so forth. When you come to God and his attributes and his actions, then the infinity and the boundlessness and the immeasurability and so on, or even incommensurability, come in. So then, for that reason, Rumi goes on, it has been said to be in reality the attribute of God. So that is the logical consequence of the definition. Since it is incalculable, since it is infinite, so it is in reality the attribute of God. God is the supreme and the main lover. And love is main attribute because it is infinite. Affection, though, as I said, the word affection may not be very appropriate here. For that reason, it has been said to be in reality the attribute of God, and unreal in relation to man, who is slave. Here again, there is another issue that comes up in what Rumi says here, we have got supposedly two kinds of love, the real and the unreal. In the case of God, we use the word for love in the real sense of the word, in the real or in the lived sense of the word. But in other cases, say in the case of human being, when we use the word love, it has got its own unreal sense. Sometimes they call it figurative love, sometimes nominal love. All these means unreal. In a figurative sense, in an unreal sense, we use the word love because love, since it is infinite, we cannot claim it. We cannot think that it is or we can actually have it. And in the case of God, of course, being used in the real sense. So far, and in this very precise and very brief definition, you will see once a number of points which is brought up by Rumi. In the first place, it is infinite. In the second, it is the attribute of God. In the third, it is a real sense of the word which is being used in the case of God. And in all other cases, it is the unreal sense. Therefore, when we talk about the relationship of love among people, if at all, that is only a kind of a shadow of love, if you like, something which cannot be considered as one. Here, of course, I would like to just mention very briefly, in brackets, another point which is relevant to the present point, and that is the idea of fear and love. I mentioned that we had two different kinds of mysticism, fear mysticism and love mysticism. Now, according to our mystics, love mysticism is more important, better, more admirable, and more significant than fear mysticism. Why? There are a number of reasons why love mysticism is better than fear mysticism. One of the reasons which is based on the definition just given here is that fear is not an attribute of God, but love is an attribute of God. Okay, now to fear God is not to share an attribute of God, but to love God is to share one of his attributes. Okay, being a lover of God takes you and draws you closer to God and makes you similar to him and gives you his image and gives him your image, because after all, according to the Old Testament and according to Islamic literature, God has created man on his own image. So we are lovers because we have been created on the image of God, imago Dei, as it is usually said. But on the basis of fear, perhaps there is no similarity, unity between man and God. So that is one of the main reasons why perhaps Rumi chooses love mysticism, though, again in brackets, according to Rumi and most of the mystics, love is not a choice. It is not a choice that you choose it, you adopt it, you want it. Love chooses you rather than you choose love, but that is a different thing altogether. So anyway, as far as Rumi is concerned, this is a very brief definition of love. But then, now, this definition, or this very brief explanation, would not be complete without, giving you or reading you some other verses from Masnavi, the first book, where he says that love is ineffable, is unexplainable, is undefinable. So what we said so far, it is perhaps one of the major characteristics of love. Otherwise, it is ineffable, and you should not venture a definition of love. In the first story of the first book of Masnavi, the story of the king and the handmaiden, the story of love, of course, is there. And as I said, since Rumi works with free associations, and the king is a lover of the handmaiden, then, of course, this takes Rumi away from the field, and he says a lot of important things about love itself, and then he goes back and turns to the main body of the story later. Now, what he says about love here is worth listening to. Whatever I say in exposition, explanation of love, When I come to love, I am ashamed of that explanation. هرچه گویم عشق را شرح و بیان، چون به عشقایم خجل مانم از آن. But so ever I say an exposition, explanation of love, when I come to love itself, I am ashamed of that explanation. Although the commentary of the tongue makes all clear, yet tongueless love is clearer. Tongueless love is clearer. گرچه تفسیر زبان روشنگر است، لیک عشق بی زبان روشنتر است. We better not to use our tongue in order to explain love. It is an experience. When you use your tongue, you make it even darker. You put a veil upon it, so to speak. In the book 3 of Masnavi, actually, again, he comes to the idea of love. And there he says, I wish the universe, the being, had a tongue in order to explain what love is. Because we do not have such tongue. We do not have such capacity in order to explain and to expose the nature and the real essence of love. So at the same time, you see that you are in front of something so mysterious, so perplexing, that you understand something about it, but when you want to explain it, you will see that you are incapable, you are unable to do that. And this applies not only to the concept of love, actually to any concept in mysticism. I told you that mysticism is a school of perplexity. It's not a school of clarity, as distinct from philosophy. Philosophy is school of clarity in the sense that philosophers, logicians, actually their main function, their main effort is in order to clarify concepts, to eradicate contradictions, to eradicate confusions, to give you precise definitions and so on and so forth. That is the business of philosophy, and to the extent that they can do it, they are successful philosophers and logicians. But in the case of mysticism, you should not expect such a thing from any contemplative. They are working with concepts and experiences, and they are dealing with a field of being and in the universe that it is utterly ineffable, unconceptualizable, perplexing, and abhorring any precise definition. That's why, although the commentary of the tongue makes all clear, yet tongueless love is clearer. Whilst the pen was making haste in writing, split upon itself as soon as it come to love. In expounding love, the intellect lay down helplessly, like an ass in the mire. It was love that uttered the explanation of love and loverhood. So, شرح عشق و عاشقی هم عشق گفت. Love and loverhood can be explained only via love itself and on the basis of the love itself. In the modern sense, in analytic philosophy, it is irreducible. It cannot be defined in other terms other than love itself. So you cannot reduce it to any other terminology, any other vocabulary, any other concept. So it can be explained on the basis of itself. If you like, logically it is circular. But it is not circular because we are not going to explain love on the basis of the concept of love, but we are going to explain love on the basis of the experience of love. So it is irreducible, but it is not circular. If you share the experience of lovers, then of course you will be able to understand what love is. You hear this from one of the greatest lovers of the world, of history, so take it seriously. I mean, it is not just playing with words. And he tells us this, and beware us of the thorny territory we are going to step in. Expounding love, the intellect lay down like an ass in the mire. عقل در شرحش چو خر در گل بخفت. شرح عشق و عاشقی هم عشق گفت. In the last analysis, it is love that uttered the explanation of love and loverhood. The proof of sun is the sun. The proof of sun is the sun himself. If thou require proof, do not avert thy face from him. If you ask somebody what is the proof of the existence of sun, what can he say to you? Just look at sun, and that is that. I mean, there is no proof of the existence of the sun other than the existence of the sun. So love is exactly like that. It is shining, it is universal, it is everywhere, but you only need two eyes and of course a will in order to see it, in order to watch it, in order to capture it. So if the shadow gives an indication of him, the sun himself gives a spiritual light every moment. Of course, shadow, here you see a very curious way of arguing about love, a very curious logical argument. Shadow, of course, is an indication of sun, of sunlight, no doubt about it, but it is a negative indication. Shadow is not a positive being, it is a negative being. Shadow is nothing. Shadow is the absence of light. Therefore, and this is a very important point in the whole Masnavi, if something is going to be an indication, a proof, an evidence for love, that thing must be nothing. That thing must claim nothing, no presence, no existence, nothing. And this is because lovers, according to Rumi, are nothing in the sense that they are selfless. So selflessness is one of the main characteristics of lovers. And a selfless evidence can be an evidence to love. Other things which claim positive existence, they are not a proper evidence or indication for love. So far, actually, again, we are, as I said, in front of a very perplexing, complex concept, i.e. love, which at the same time receives and accepts definition and does not accept definition. And I dare say it is full of contradictions and contradictory characteristics as we go on to learn about it. Another point which I have to mention here is this, that Rumi says that my book is a book of love, no doubt about it. He gives a very good explanation of this. He said, if you go to the shop of a cloth dealer, okay, what you will see there is cloth, is garment. That is the main commodity for sale. But of course you might meet or might see an iron bar. That is for measurement. It is not serious. It is just besides the point. It is something which is not for sale. Now he says, you might see many things in my book, but those are not very serious. They are not intended to be there. The main commodity in my book, in my shop, is love, is unity, according to him, which is one of the main characteristics of love. The rest are just there in order to make love more conspicuous, more apparent, to be seen and to be observed by observers. Okay. Another point which is also worth mentioning here is this business of the real and unreal love. Now, we hear that on the one hand we have got the real love, which is the divine love, the love which is an attribute of God, and lovers who love God, and then we have got the unreal. But it is not the case that there is no connection whatsoever between the unreal and the real. The unreal love leads somehow or other to the real love, if taken seriously. The unreal love, it has got an introductory, it is an introductory phase, if you like, and it can lead you to the real love, provided you take it seriously. So this much, actually, they admire human love, non-divine love, unreal love. But not for the sake of it, but for the sake of the goal and the telos that is there, and it will lead to. So all unreal love are admirable, are precious, are valuable, insofar as they can lead you to the divine and to the real love. Rumi, for example, in Masnavi mentions the story of some well-known lovers. You know, for example, Layli and Majnun, which are two lovers in Arab literature. Sometimes of Khosrow and Shirin in Persian literature and some others. But only in order to clarify the divine love through these stories and to tell us that these unreal ones are so overwhelming, then you have to know the real one and the infinite affection that we might have. So you can guess what that infinite affection might do with human beings. Okay, so much for the introductory remarks about the concept of love and its perplexing nature. But what about the main characteristics of love itself? So far, I have been talking of love as a kind of kindness or affection and so on, but these are very incomplete definitions or explanations of love. In order to understand what love means for Rumi, you have to take into consideration that for Rumi, love is a mode of being. It is not an affection, it is not an attribute, it is not a dimension of a lover. It is the whole personality of the lover, and as I said, it is a mode of being. It is exactly like life and lifelessness. You see, to be lifeless is a mode of being, and to be living is another mode of being. And these two are very different from each other. When something is living, is alive, all its attributes, all its dimensions are alive. It is not the case that in a living being something is dead and something else is alive. The whole being is alive. Lifelessness and livingness or life itself. So these are two different things. There is such a difference between two personalities or two persons. One of them is a lover, and the other one is a rational being. So rationality, if you like, or intellect, or reason, or whatever, is a mode of being, and loverhood or love is another mode of being. So there are two different persons altogether. When love comes to you, or perhaps when you are entangled with love, it is not just a coloration. You are not colored by love. Your whole personality will be reshuffled and changed, and you are being replaced, so to speak. This is the experience of Rumi himself. In one of his odes in Divan, which apparently describes his state of mind after meeting with Shams. He says, "I was dead. No, I am alive. I was all in tears. No, I am all in laughter. And I was perishable. No, I am eternal. Thanks to the love. مرده بودم زنده شدم گریه بودم خنده شدم دولت عشق آمد و من دولت پاینده شدم. I was perishable, I was nothing, I was mortal. No, I am eternal. Everything has changed in me. I am a different being altogether. My mode of being is now different. I am a different person altogether. That is the meaning of love according to him. It is not just a part or an element or a particular dimension or a coloring, as I said, that is not the case. Everything becomes changed and reshuffled and modified as if a new personality is born. And that is the second birth. Of course, is a very apt description of what goes on in the personality and in the being of the lover. A new birth, a second birth. The concept or the idea of a second birth is there explicitly in Rumi. When you are born a second birth, then you will become a different person altogether. Even your philosophical worldview will become different. You will leave behind all those philosophical thinkings about causality, about determination, about the structure of the universe and everything. You will see the universe in a new light. and the relationships between things become different to you. You understand things in a different way and see things under a different light. Everything will become different. You are a new person, you get new eyes, you see things under new lights, and you are a different person. You will have a different relationship with the world altogether. And that's why he said that lovers are always joyful. They are not subject to sorrow at all, at all. That is because of their peculiar relationship with the world. Sorrow and joy, of course, they have got their own causes, their own conditions. And under some conditions you become sorrowful, under some other conditions you become joyful, and so on and so forth. But for lovers, as if they are so different that they never become sorrowful. And joy is their lot, I mean, all through their life. And there are many other things to be said in this respect. But the second birth is the main concept here. Now let us see what Rumi has got to tell us about the characteristics of a lover. When you become a lover, or perhaps when love comes to you, when your mode of being is changed, when you are alive after being dead, and so on, what would happen to you? Now, there are altogether, I mean, I have enumerated the eight characteristics I will mention to you here, but I'm sure that there are many others, and you can find them in Masnavi for yourself. These are, of course, based on Rumi's Masnavi. When you go to the odes, of course, you will find an ocean of concepts, of ideas there, which are really uncalculable according to him. And so what I'm doing, according to him himself, I am pouring an ocean into a jar, in a small jar. So his gift to us is an ocean, but my gift to you is just a small jar. But this is an indication of what is there behind it. So this can lead you to the ocean. Now the first characteristic of a lover, according to him, is humility and selflessness, as I said, as opposed to arrogance and proudness in rational beings. No, remember again, there we are now dealing with two different types of personality and two modes of being, as I said. On the one hand, you have got a humble person, which is the lover. On the other, you have got the philosopher, or the rational being. Rational beings, they are proud, they are arrogant, according to Rumi. And this arrogance is not eliminable from their mode of being. This was the experience of Ghazali, actually, and the experience of Rumi himself. And the whole history of thought is witness to that. Ghazali has got a very long exposition of theologians of his time in Ihya ul-Ulum, describing their attitudes toward each other, their attitudes toward truth especially. According to Ghazali, for most of the philosophers and theologians, they would like truth to be subordinate to them, rather than themselves to be subordinate to truth, you see. They would like to defame truth rather than to be defamed themselves. Especially he talks about the debates between theologians and philosophers. He says that in their debates you wouldn't find an element of truth. It is all their selves and egos at war with each other. And they are there in order to win over their rivals. It is not the case. They are not seeking the truth for the sake of the truth. They are seeking their own pride. They are seeking, they are inflating their egos, I mean, in front of their followers and other people. So seemingly and apparently philosophers claim a lot about their business, their school of thought, their system of thought. It is based on truth. It is for the sake of truth. They are seeking the truth. They are arguing, and they are dealing with arguments and counter-arguments in order to capture the truth and nothing but the truth. But according to Rumi and according to Ghazali, all these are verbiage. All these are just empty talk about truth. Look when they come into debate with each other. So you will see that there it is only their personalities which is at stake, and they would like to show that they are the dominant, they are the winners, and they are the capturers and the owners of the truth. So in the case of rationality, reason and intellect, proudness or pride and arrogance is something which is, so to speak, resident in the mind and in the personality and in the mode of being of a philosopher. He cannot avoid it. He cannot avoid it. I say this while I am one of the people who are, my main business is philosophy, and so you can take my testimony as a first-hand experience on that. So, and Ghazali and Rumi also, actually, they had the whole history of thought in front of themselves. And they had, especially Ghazali, the first-hand experience of theologians of his age. He has written, as I said, very lengthy articles about this business. And that's why, actually, the second characteristics of lovers come in. And that is the unity. All lovers are one and the same. There is no dispute between them. There is no separation. There is, since it is only the arrogance which make people different from each other, which make them and bring them at war with each other. But when there is no dispute, there is always unity, and that's why I said the unity is one of the main characteristics of love. And Rumi told us that the main commodity to be sold in his book and his shop is the commodity of unity. Unity comes through love. Lovers all are the same. There is a story in Rumi, actually in Shams, in his dialogues. He says that in a court, when the judge asked the plaintiff to bring him two witnesses, he brought two Sufis. But the judge said, no, these two are one. They are not two people. Even if you bring 1,000 of them, I wouldn't consider them as two witnesses. They are only one. Bring me two witnesses, you see. That's why lovers all think the same, have got the same personality, have got the same mode of beings. They are not proud of themselves. Their egos are not inflated. They are not at war with each other. They have got the same experience. And they experience the world, similarly and not differently. But in the case of philosophers, there are schools after schools, suppositions after suppositions, disputes over disputes, and so on and so forth. And everybody tries to prove himself rather than to prove the truth, rather than to prove the reality, and so on. So the humility, the humbleness, you see, is the characteristic of lovers. In the extreme sense, on the extreme end, this humility or humbleness sometimes is called nothingness, you see, or absence altogether. So when we talk about nothingness, it means a kind of humility. And this humility necessarily is not a moral humility, ethical humility. I'm not saying that it contradicts that, but it cannot be, should not be confined to the moral humility. In moral humility, you are something, but you know that you have not to be proud of yourself. This is a kind of knowledge that makes you humble. But in the case of love, it is not a deliberate humility. It is your mode of being. It becomes nothing. You do not consider yourself as anything. You are so dissolved in your love and in your beloved that virtually you are not a pretentious person. You do not pretend. You do not claim any right for yourself. Nothing. So this is the meaning of the real humility here. The second characteristic, and as I said, in the case of the intellect or reason, some sort of arrogance or other is inevitable. The second is courage, as opposed to timidity in the case of the rational being. Cautiousness is actually attached and associated with reason. If you are a rational being, if you are a reasonable, sensible person, you have to be cautious. I mean, this is, after all, the main function of reason, in order to tell you how to calculate your loss and gain, your cost and benefit, and to be cautious not to lose, and to be cautious how to gain something for yourself. And if you are, I mean, too clever to even to deceive others. So this is, after all, the main business of reason and rationality. I am not saying that it is necessarily a bad or a negative thing, but this is what it is. I mean, let us be quite clear about it. This is the main essence, the main nature of reason. Reason, in essence, is a calculator. And if you do not know how to calculate your gain and loss, so you are not a rational person. Economical rationality especially, I mean, is very prominent here. But in the case of love, it is not like this. It is courageous in the sense that it is not cautious. A lover is courageous because he is not a calculating person. First of all, he is selfless. Secondly, he is careless about his. Secondly, he is a man or a person of risk. You see, reason does not allow you to risk. He only tells you and permits you to calculate. And when the likeliness of the gain, I mean, is more, then you have to step in order to gain more. And when the likeliness of danger is more, so you have to abstain and to sit back and not to take action. But love is not like this. And if you look at the world and the history of man, all great things and great actions has been made by lovers rather than by rational people. Philosophers have not been the source of any great impact on the history, only lovers. Whether the prophets, the martyrs, the mystics and others, poets and so on, they have had the greatest impact on human beings since they were selfless, careless about themselves, not calculating, I mean in a rational, economical, egoistic way about the gain and loss, and they were just sacrificing themselves. So sacrifice, carelessness in this sense, not being calculating, not being cautious, is another characteristic of love. And as I said, for Rumi, I mean, compare Rumi with all other personalities in the history, such as Ibn Sina, Avicenna, and many others. I tell you that at least in the Islamic history, Rumi has been much more effective and had a deeper impact on the history of Islamic civilization than Ibn Sina and others, because he was a lover. And Ghazali, when he became a lover, when he became a mystic, when he was a thinker, of course he was a great thinker, but that was a different thing altogether. In the case of love, what Rumi tells us is this business of the courage, which of course is associated and very close with the selflessness. You will see in the whole body of Masnavi that Rumi loves Ishmael a lot. Of course, this goes back to the history of the Old Testament and the history of Abraham. Now, Abraham had two sons, Isaac and Ishmael. But he was ordered by God to take one of his sons to slaughter. According to the Islamic literature, that son was Ishmael, of course. But according to the Jewish literature, that son was Isaac. Strangely and surprisingly enough, Rumi does not distinguish between the two. Sometimes he says that the victim, if you like, or the martyr-to-be was Isaac, and sometimes he says he was the Ishmael. So this again must tell us something, that he did not much bother about history. He just bothered about the content rather than the container. Once in one place in Masnavi actually he says this exactly, that think about the content, not the container. Now whoever was the victim, whoever was the son of the Abraham, that does not matter. The very idea of the slaughter and the courage, both on the part of the father and on the part of the son, is what actually means to Rumi. He is so fond of Ishmael, or Ismail in Arabic. In one place in the book 3, he said, Mantra Ismail Yanam bi Hazar Mantra Ismail Azadam. I am like the assassins, I am like the Ismail himself. I like him and I am like them. You know, assassins, the sect in the 5th and 6th century Islamic calendar, who were a very big threat to the Khilafat and the establishment of the time. They were called Ismailis, you know. Of course, in Western literature, they are assassins. And assassins, of course, even the word comes from them, because they were supposed to really assassinate people. The real word is Hashashin, and Hashashin means the people who used herbs and grass, I mean, particularly grass, because it is in their story that they used grass in order to become intoxicated and then try assassinations of others. Now the word assassin comes from there. It is a version of Hashashin. And anyway, when Rumi says that he likes assassins, do not think that he was fond of murdering people. No, because the real and the original name of this assassin was Ismailis, and their sect was called Ismailiyya. So he said, Mantra Ismailiyanam bihazar, I am courageous like the assassins. I am like Ishmael, free from head. I do not bother, I do not think of my head. I am so courageous and so prepared to offer my head to my beloved, and so on. So, and sometimes, of course, as I said, he uses the word Ishaq, means Isaac. Mawquf farman tu'am, Ishaq qurban tu'am. I am your Isaac. And